Hi, I'm Bill Nemitz, and welcome to another edition of Born to Run, our podcast with gubernatorial primary candidates in which we step away from the politics and the policy and look at the people and listen to the life stories that brought many of these, all of these candidates to the ballot in June. Our guest today is Mark Dion. Where do I begin? Former Cumberland County Sheriff, former state representative, current state senator, and candidate for governor. Welcome, Mark.
Welcome. Well, I appreciate it, Bill.
It's good to have you here. You know, one of the things that prompted this whole series was the power of one personal narrative when it came to a run for the Blaine House, and that was Paula Page back in 2010 when he told his story about growing up on the hardscrabble streets of Lewiston and kind of lifting himself up by the bootstraps and ultimately ending up first as mayor of Waterville and then in the Blaine House. Well, we got another Lewiston guy here today.
That's right.
You grew up in Lewiston.
About the same time as Paul did.
Did you ever meet him?
No.
No?
We didn't cross. He's a little bit older than I, so I'm his junior that way. But I've always smiled and wondered how it became Gotham for him, because I didn't have that experience. I have a much more pleasant memory of growing up in that city.
Fond feelings for Lewiston.
Yeah, Lewiston's a great city. At that time, it was the mills were working. I can remember going down to the gate when my grandmother was coming out of the Bates Mill and the flood of human beings coming across the canal bridge at the end of the day. It was a real family city. I noticed it when I moved to Portland. In Portland, you identify what neighborhood you live in, but in Lewiston, you identify with your parish. So you'd say, hey, I'm from Holy Cross, or you live at Holy Family. Mm-hmm. So church was very central.
What was your church?
Holy Cross.
Holy Cross.
Mm-hmm. It's a church you see when you go up the turnpike.
Yeah.
It's a white stone church.
Mm-hmm. And you were one of four?
Five.
Five kids.
There was five of us in a two-bedroom apartment. One little tiny bathroom.
Was this downtown or where in Lewiston?
This is on Pleasant Street. It's kind of like the fringe of where it starts to become a little bit more residential in terms of single family homes. We lived in a two family apartment building. My paternal grandparents lived on the first floor. We were on the second floor.
French speakers?
Absolutely. French was the language at home. We had three pictures in the living room. Jack Kennedy, Pope John, and Queen Elizabeth. Well, my grandmother never broke her allegiance to the Dominion of Canada and to the Queen, and Jack Kennedy was a hero to us politically, and Pope John was an affirmation of who we saw ourselves to be. We're French Catholics.
Yeah, and he was a very popular figure, unlike some of his successors.
Exactly.
So your father, if I recall, was a fireman.
He was a firefighter. Right? He was of the generation, he had an eighth grade education. It was still a time where your back was more important necessarily than your intellect. And he made it onto the fire department. He had been a bus driver prior to that, and he was a union man. So my first exposure to unions was in the firehouse. For that matter, my first exposure that men could cook was at the firehouse, because I could walk to the station he was assigned to, and you know, the men shared household duties there. They had a home to take care of. It was the Lisbon Street Station, and they grew their own vegetables, and they shared meats and fish that they gathered during the week. And so I grew up learning that men do cook. It's not a...
And your mom, was she a homemaker?
She was a homemaker. Mm-hmm. She stayed home
and took care of all of you.
Took care of all of us. It was a handful.
Where were you in the five kids?
I was the oldest.
Oldest? Oh, boy.
I know.
Carrier of the torch.
Carrier of the torch. You're responsible for what your siblings do. You're supposed to look out for them. And my father held me to that standard, so it wasn't easy being oldest.
And Catholic school, I assume?
Catholic school, taught by nuns. Half the day was in French, half was in English.
Were you a good guy with the nuns?
I was a good guy.
I
stayed on their good side. That could be, I mean, they believed in corporal punishment, and I was subjected to it from time to time, so I wasn't perfect. But there was thoughts that I would go on to seminary.
Well, if you were a boy in Catholic school, that came with the...
So I did the best I could. I became a cop instead. That's the Irish formula, isn't it?
You must have been an altar boy.
I did that. I did choir. I did lecture. You know, we went to mass most mornings before we started school.
So you stayed out of trouble.
I stayed out of trouble.
Well, it's probably why you didn't meet Paula Page. So, you know, I mean. Yeah.
Well, no, I mean, we got into hijinks just like everyone else, but it was an era where everybody's mother was your mother. So you felt like you couldn't get away with much because everybody would be able to report back to mom and dad. So, you know, norms were taken care of that way.
Yeah. Now, when it came, where'd you go to high school?
I went to Lewiston. There was a big debate in my household as to whether or not I should go to St. Dominic's to continue the Catholic piece. But we used to have the priest come over every couple of Sundays for dinner down in my grandparents' apartment. And with the talk of seminary and everything, I thought it was best to make my case.
Okay, you had to make your break early. Huh?
That's right. It had to happen then.
Really, it was the pressure was building.
Yeah, I don't know why I didn't want to be a priest, but I knew I shouldn't be.
Do you think you would have made a good priest?
Yeah, I think I would have. I mean,
are you spiritual enough to be a priest?
Yes, I'm spiritual in a very practical, street way.
Yeah.
You know, I always believe if Christ, when he does come back, he'll be wearing jeans and a flannel shirt, and he'll probably be being released from a county jail somewhere.
Now, you came from a family that had no college experience.
No college, no. You know, I keep a framed book of S&H green stamps in my office. And I do that because my mother was passionate about my reading. And she would save these S&H books and purchase one letter of the alphabet for this huge Rand McNally dictionary. And my father would say, then read it. If she got it, you read it. So over the course of many months, I read the entire dictionary. And then she went on to use those same S&H green stamps to purchase an encyclopedia. And the routine was the same. If she got you the letter A for the encyclopedia, read it. So my father was always had mixed feelings. Like, I think he wanted me to be like him, big, strong, physical. But at the same time, he recognized almost intuitively that intellectual issues had to be engaged in as well. And mom was much more about that.
She pushed you in that
She
direction.
Pushed me. She's the one that got me to read the editorial page every day in the newspaper and then talk to her about it.
Yeah.
I don't ever remember her reading the newspaper, but it was like an assignment that I would read it and then report out to her.
Yet your father, I assume we'll get to this in a minute, instilled in you the sense of public service. And
public
service.
You know? Yeah, with the fire department. I mean, the public service, he believed in. He says, look, you always take care of the elderly. Whatever they need, meet that need. That's your responsibility. You take care of everyone who's younger than you because that's your role, okay, as the eldest. And that translated into be the eldest in a neighborhood later in my life. Mm-hmm. So those were the kinds of things that he did. And he also instilled in me the ethic of being a father, that you're responsible for a family. And that might mean you sacrifice. I mean, he wasn't one to say, I love you. He demonstrated it by, and he used to say, you have plenty to eat. There'll always be food here. Your needs will be met. I mean, he was a very practical, understated individual.
Did you ever worry for him in his job?
Yeah. I think one of the memories, there was a fire down on Lincoln Street, which has, like, at the time, big oil tanks and industrial sites, and it had been in all hands. Everyone in the city was there. We could see the black smoke rolling up into the sky. We were on a place called Applesass Hill, our house, and mom was really worried, and later on, when he came home, he was covered with soot. And that was the first time that we really worried, and mom talked to us about how dangerous Dad's job was.
He goes in.
You know, we didn't say he doesn't come back out, but there was this real fear that things could happen. And later on, he had responded to a house fire that turned into a natural gas explosion, and he was caught in that. But he always came out of it. I mean, a dad prided himself in all the years of his work life. He never took a sick day. There were days even I could see that he shouldn't go in, but it was part of his ethic of being responsible. You show up, you know.
So off to college you go. You went to
college is I just want to laugh. When I thought about going to college, I remember having all the catalogs from the guiding office.
Yeah.
I mentioned it to my father. He says, well, you can go to whichever one you can afford. And because he felt at that time in his life, any money he had to stay with my sisters and
was
my
college
brother.
A luxury?
Yeah, it was
a necessary luxury.
A necessary luxury. When I graduated from high school, he took me down to the shed and he opened up the door and there was this chair of terrible flower print on it. I always remember it. And on it was a little plastic, green plastic television, black and white. And he says, look, this is all man needs, a good chair, his TV. And he reached in his pocket and gave me $50. And then he took a drag from his cigarette and blew it out and said, everything else is up to you. And then he walked back up into the house. And college, he never pressed me about my grades. But
you
he
went
always,
to the University of
Maine.
What is now USM.
USM.
UMPG it was at the
UMPG
time.
UMPG at the time. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So his concern was, what are you doing for work? How are you making your bills? Have you enough to pay for school? And I says, Dad, I'm okay. And he always was there in the summers to support me in whatever kind of work.
What did you do for work?
Oh, my God. I drove a delivery truck for food service, pushing lunch carts at the shoe shops in Freeport. Then Dad got me a job at the foundry. He thought that would be good for me. He was still trying to have me live up to his blue-collar ideal. The foundry was wonderful. I mean, it was hard work, melting brass. We did fittings for sailboats, so I was a grinder and worked hard, but I enjoyed it. The men.
Probably good money, decent money. I would
it was assume. Decent money mm-hmm. at the time. Mm-hmm. The owner really liked me. He kind of tried to solicit me to stay on and learn the trade. Then I went on to Country Kitchen, worked in an industrial bakery. Later on, when I had enough education, I got my first job in my soon-to-be profession was for Tom Delahanty. He was the county attorney at the time. For those who are listening, he's a judge and had been mm-hmm. U.S. attorney. But he gave me my first job as an administrative assistant clerk to the grand jury.
In the DA's office.
Yeah, but then I met my first detective, and I got the disease, and I would hurry through my paperwork.
Well, to back up, you majored in criminal.
I majored in criminology. I started in biology. My mother had hoped that I was going to be a doctor. I love science. But then I took criminology as someone told me it would be an easy elective.
Okay.
And that was the end of that.
Isn't that funny? That happened with me with journalism.
Really?
Too. You know, it's an easy elective, and then all of a sudden you realize you're passionate about this.
That's right.
What was it about criminology or police work that attracted you?
People. I find people fascinating. I've always questioned why they do what they do. How does it happen? Why do they make the choices they do? So really, in a way, it was the psychology of crime mm-hmm. that always attracted me and stayed with me. And the history part of crime, why we decide certain things are criminal as opposed to not. Mm-hmm.
Which has ebbed and flowed throughout your whole career. Look at marijuana, for example.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the value system that the nuns and priests had placed embedded in my psyche got stretched and pulled and really turned around as I became a criminologist.
So you got out of USM and or UMPG, and off you went to the Portland Police Department. Right?
Off I did, yeah. It was
young rookie cop?
Yeah, it was. Well, I wanted to go to the Lewiston Police Department. I wanted to go home. Okay. And I applied, and one of my sisters was working for the city clerk at the time. And she says, gee, you scored number one in the exam. You did great on the orals, and I had passed the physical. And I always remember it was Chief Hervé Gendreau. He had a cigar going really wet and short. And he says, look, kid, you're really smart, but I'm not going to hire you. And I said, why? Because you're kind of stunned when you hear that. I mean, I'm 21 years old. I didn't know defeat came so early. He said, the candidate behind you is married and has kids. He needs that job. You'll do okay. And sitting with him was a professor from Bates. His last name was Sylvester. He was chair of the police commission. And he kind of shook his head. Later on, I graduate from the police academy, and he's handing out our certificates. And when he shook my hand, he goes, Lewiston's loss will be Portland's gain.
Who hired you in Portland?
Bill McLaren.
Oh, Bill McLaren. How about that?
Yeah. I can remember he hired three of us, and he was in his office, and, you know, he sat on the front of his office. It was very informal, and he talked about his philosophy of policing, and
He was into community policing before it became a thing.
Before it had a label, you know. So I really heard him, and it really was kind of inspiring that that's what police work was going to be about.
Mm-hmm. Which really played right in with your attraction in the first
place.
That's right. Yeah, it attracted to the people side of it.
You know, later on, where he and I are both professors at SMCC.
Right, you teach together, right.
You know, and I says, it looks like what you said on that day worked out.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to think he was proud of my career there.
Sure. Now, you served with a number of chiefs, Frank Amoroso and ultimately Mike Chitwood.
Yeah.
You were kind of Chief Chitwood's number two guy, and then went on to become, to run your own department,
That's
Cumberland
right.
County Sheriff's Department, for which you, I think, three terms you served there?
Three terms.
Yep. Now, I'd be interested in hearing you compare and contrast your executive style as sheriff with that of Chief Chitwood as a chief, because the two of you seemed to work very well together when you were at Portland PD, but I remember even at the time, you couldn't really come up with two people who were more
different.
Yeah.
I think that's why it worked. I mean, I learned the very best from Mike Chitwood, and I was exposed to maybe strategies that I would later reject. Mike enjoyed confrontation. I don't walk away from a good fight, but that's not the way to start a dialogue. And I used to remember he'd create an issue with someone, then bring me in the office. He says, now your job is to go make peace. I've put you in a position that you can negotiate what it is we want.
Good cop, bad cop.
Good cop. He played that to the hilt.
Yeah.
But he did teach me about the power of the media, if you want to advocate. He did teach me that your first responsibility is to the officers, and always advocate on their behalf.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But at the same time, on social issues, I'll give him credit. When I, you know, first went to him on whether it was immigrant issues or gay rights, he was open. He wanted to hear about it, and he blessed risk taking on serving those constituencies. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, he brought me in the office one day. He goes, look, let's stop fooling around. You need to go to graduate school. One day you will be a chief. And I went to grad school, and he was the dad that I didn't have in my undergraduate
years. Yeah, pushing you.
He wanted to know my grades. He wanted to know my projects.
Now, was this when you went to the Kennedy School, or was this?
No, this is when I went to Antioch College.
Oh, okay.
I got a master's in Human Services Administration.
And then after that, you went to
the Kennedy School.
The Kennedy School on a fellowship.
I did.
And after that, you went to UMaine Law School.
That's right.
So really, and that culminated in what, 2006?
Six.
You got your law degree. So really, this whole education thing has been a thread throughout
my entire
pretty
life.
Much your whole life.
I start my day reading at 5. I read, whether first the newspapers, and then I usually have a couple books that I take pieces of. I mean, it's a discipline. And once you adopt it, it becomes your routine.
Yeah. And now you're on the other side of the fence as an attorney. You're doing some criminal work.
I do criminal defense work.
Yeah. What's that like? You know, I mean, you go into court now, you're the guy on the right-hand side instead of the left-hand side. You're not at the prosecutor's table anymore. Has it changed your perspective?
It's given me the whole picture.
Yeah.
You know, I think some of the happiest times I had as a cop was when I was a detective, because I wanted to solve the puzzle and put a case together. And I remember Dick Olson was the sergeant running the bureau at the time. He always said, don't build your case for the state. Build it for the defense. Answer all their questions, and you'll get the conviction. Now I am the defense. And it's interesting, because I'll get police reports, but now I have a client who will tell me his or her version of the truth, and it kind of fills in the gaps. At first, many of my colleagues said, oh my God, you've gone over to the dark side. And I took all that kind of ribbing. But then the phone would ring, and it'd be a police officer saying, oh, you know, my brother-in-law, he's really a good guy, and I don't know how he screwed this up, but can you help him out? Oh, now you need the dark.
You need a good defense attorney.
But I think as a practical matter, I understand the system enough that I think judges pay attention when I have analysis. And I don't talk about punishment. I talk about accountability. I talk about rehabilitation. I don't challenge the state on what could be frivolous issues. Usually I get to the substance, and we talk about outcomes. So I think I'm an effective defense attorney.
And on top of all this, you decided to become a politician.
Yeah, I mean.
I mean, what's up with that?
I don't know. They recruit when
I'm not busy enough.
Well, first of all, I decided consciously to leave being sheriff.
Yeah, which was a political job.
It was a political job. Right. And at the end of my third term, I told everyone I'm not running for a fourth term. I sincerely believe agencies need to have a turnover of senior leadership. That's how they stay healthy. So I knew it was time to go, and I wanted to go at the top of my game. Things were going well. And I think I satisfied a lot of my agenda at the time. But they recruited me to go to the House. It's funny. They made it sound like it was so part-time I could phone it in and still have – well, they lie.
They say that to everyone.
I know they do. But I enjoy policymaking. I thought I brought something to the table. And by my second year, I was chairing criminal justice. And then later on, there were real challenges in energy, which I had started off at in the House of Representatives as an energy committee member. I chaired that as well. Mm-hmm. So I think it's kind of unusual to come out of that process.
Well, to have touched down in so many different arenas in the public sector, I think, is certainly unusual. Let's come full circle here, because we started off by talking to about your family in Lewiston. Let's talk about your family here in Portland. You have two daughters?
Two daughters. I'll start with my wife first.
I was going to go get to her, too. How did you meet your wife?
I met her at a fraternity party. One of my other fraternity brothers was seriously interested in her, and he came to me. He says, I can't seem to make the connection. She's being very evasive, that type of, what you talk about when you're 19, 20, 21 years old. And I says, look, no problem. Next time she comes over, I'll talk to her. We'll see what we can do. Well, we had that conversation late into the night, into the next morning, and it was successful, just not on his behalf. Some friend.
Some friend
turned out
thrilled.
To be. Although today he chuckles, and, Cheryl and I have been together 40 years.
40 years. Huh?
Yeah. Hmm. So it worked. She's been a great partner. She's really honest with me. And if you can survive 40 years of marriage, some of this other political stuff's not that complicated. Yeah. So I have two daughters, 34 and 32 years old. The eldest has her own design company in Oceanside, California. Her and her husband have given us our first grandchild, a little boy named Dylan. He's 2 years old this month. Brittany lives in Phoenix. She's a speech pathologist in a trauma hospital for a brain injury. Hmm. And her husband's a software developer, so they're doing well. Hmm. But I regret they're not in Maine.
Yeah,
I mean,
must.
That's one of the things
way.
I talk
Phoenix
about.
Phoenix and Southern California.
I call it my Western States tour. I usually touch down Phoenix, do what we have to do there, then drive across the desert to California.
Yeah. So which is a great drive.
It is. Yeah. It's fun.
Yeah. But it ain't Maine.
It's not Maine. Yeah. And, it's hard to have a relationship on FaceTime.
And your family growing up, your folks have passed on, I assume?
No, my dad's still
alive.
Oh,
your dad's still alive.
He always reminded me during my political career, that's my money you're spending. No, he was dead serious about it. And he has become so a news junkie. He's got news on all the time. It's really funny. So he's very aware of what's
more
going
so
on.
More so than
in
the
past.
In the day?
Back in the day, he understood city politics as a union person.
Which was a survival technique.
That's right. But he didn't pay a lot of attention, I think, to state politics or national politics. I mean, he was a Democrat in the old Labor Democrat model. But no, he watches that. My mom, it's been about 15 years. Mm-hmm. She's gone.
Where's your dad? Is your dad still in Lewiston?
He's still in Lewiston. Mm-hmm. I mean, he thinks going on a trip is Auburn.
Living independently?
He is. Mm-hmm. He shouldn't. We've argued about it all the time. He's too stubborn. He just won't do it. He's got a neighbor that does a lot of check-in and works with him. Yeah. But he just feels real strong that he can take care of
but
himself.
But you know that angst that a lot of our generation feel right now if your parents are still alive, where the almost complete role reversal where you're looking out for them now, right?
Exactly. I mean, that's why I say that's one of our biggest issues, if not the biggest issue, is what's our strategy for a population that is going to be just old.
So are you like the rock star in your family?
No.
I mean, when you go to a family reunion, is everybody like, oh, you know, here comes?
No, my.
Given all the things you've achieved.
No, it's never. How can I put this? No, I think we all see each other equally. I mean, one of my sisters, she became a financial aid director for Central Maine Community College. She's very bright, very talented. I think she should go into politics. She's very community and social. My youngest sister is an accomplished businesswoman herself. One of my other sisters I lost to brain cancer, so she's not with us. My brother is a chief operating officer of a really significant construction company in Massachusetts. They did a lot on the Big Dig and on the bridge. He's a tunnel expert.
Hmm.
So, no, we're all accomplished in our own way. I think Mom and Dad are pleased at the outcomes. They've teased me because I'm running for governor. You know, they still don't believe that they're ever going to call me governor. They say, you'll always be Mark. And you're not going to really live in Augusta, are you? No, it keeps you grounded. I mean,
yeah.
No.
Well, that's what we all need.
Exactly.
Days, somebody to remind us where we came from and who we really are. I wish we could go on further,
all
but
right.
We've used up all our time. Mark Dion, Democratic candidate for governor, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
I'm Bill Nemitz, and this has been another edition of Born to Run. You can find this and the other gubernatorial podcasts at pressherald.com.